From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, as the U.S. government shutdown continues, Nicole Hines of Davenport, Iowa, whose family needs food assistance, has to make some hard decisions about how they will eat.
I'm just hoping that they open up so everybody can go back to their lives and be able to eat and survive.
And later, some of the new tools the U.S. government is using to monitor people. Do they violate everybody's liberties? Also, William Boyd's new spy novel and Stellan Skarsgård on his new film about a famed director who tries to recharge his relationship with two daughters that he's scarcely known. First, we have our newscast. It's Saturday, November 8, 2025.
KAXC News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. We're introducing a new series, North Star Students. We want to highlight Northern Minnesota students who deserve to be recognized, whether that's for their athletic accomplishments, artistic endeavors, academic achievements, or other efforts. Here's what you can expect. With each North Star student, we'll have an interview with them on the KAXC Morning Show. There will also be a feature story and photos on our website, kaxe.org. Our first ever North Star student is Bemidji senior Abby Damon. She was nominated by her swim coaches, Lisa Freet and Danielle Bartz. They say Damon is really stepping up as a leader this year, volunteers many hours, and is a strong, silent example of what hard work can look like. Here's an excerpt of our interview with Damon and Bartz, starting with why she was nominated.
Just wonderful human being. She's a hard worker. She's positive. She's encouraging, good athlete or good student athlete. And so I think she's kind of got a good holistic picture of, or like working towards, you know, the academic and the athlete part, and being a good role model for everybody. She's inspiring to me every day. So I thought she'd be a perfect candidate.
Do you have any favorite Abby memories?
Oh, man. I don't know if I can think of anything on the spot. She's just a joy to work with every day. She's always working hard, which is awesome to see. And just smiley. And yeah, I'm trying to think of like a fun story, but
Fargo.
West. Every single one. We have a West Fargo invite every year, and I think even this year, she was sick. Every year she's been sick. The first year I was with the team, we ended up having to pull over because she was barfing on the bus. but she's still like, she was a trooper about it. And yeah, so this year she got to compete again, which was exciting. But yeah, still got sick. She's consistent. So we like to talk about that quite a bit, I guess.
Abby, I wanted to ask you, what achievement in swimming are you most proud of?
I think I'm really proud that I've always kind of kept like a positive mindset about things. Like sometimes after a bad race, I'm like, oh my gosh, like that was just awful. But I've never like tore myself down to a point where I'm just like, I'm absolutely not doing this anymore. And also achievement, I just hope I have made a lasting impact on the younger girls on the team and that they can look up to me, and hopefully in the future they want to be like, have some of my traits too. So
what about outside of swimming? As your, you know, senior year, you're looking back quite a bit. What are some of your kind of accomplishments, whether in school or in other activities that you're proud of and thinking about a lot these days?
I'm really proud of like my work ethic, especially in school. Like I go home and I have a routine every night, and I do homework for like 2.5 hours, and it sucks. But also like you feel good when you have the grades you do. So school has been a big accomplishment for me.
And Danielle, is there anything, I don't think Abby's the bragging type, so is there anything she didn't say that she should have?
No, I think she's got it. Yeah, I'm glad that you're proud of how you're working hard in school and in the water. And seeing that, putting all that hard work and the time, and like it really can suck sometimes a lot, like it's worth it. And she's able to see that and know that it's going to be paying off in the end.
That was our first North Star student, Bemidji senior Abby Damon, and her swim coach, Danielle Bartz. Visit kaxe.org for photos and more on Damon, including the full interview. There, you can also nominate someone you know for North Star student. We want to highlight students that might not always be in the spotlight, but deserve to be recognized. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at kaxe.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
In addition, from NPR News, I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The government shutdown has halted child care and food benefits for millions of low-income Americans, including Head Start programs and a pause in supplemental nutritional assistance payments.
I received my last one about the 4th of October, because that's when I get mine, but I have not received them. I've been calling almost every day on my food stamps since the 4th, and still not received anything.
Nicole Hines is 38 years old. She lives in Davenport, Iowa, with her grandmother and 16-year-old daughter, who has an 8-month-year-old baby named Haley. Earlier this week, a federal court ordered the Trump administration to fully fund SNAP benefits for November by Friday, yesterday. The Trump administration appealed this, and just last night, the Supreme Court issued an administrative stay, which blocks the order to fully fund SNAP while the appeal plays out. Some states have started giving payments to their residents anyway. Many have not. Nicole Hines doesn't know when she will receive her money. And while she waits, she's trying to get by.
My daughter needs nutrition. My granddaughter is needing all that. So I'm taking over the responsibility of what my grandma used to do, of making sure us kids ate before she did. I'm doing that to them now.
Well, do you ever go hungry?
Not really. I make sure, you know, my daughter makes sure there's a little bit of food for me. Like when we make potatoes and gravy, she makes sure there's like enough that I would eat, because I don't eat much, but I eat enough to keep myself going.
Have you gone to any food banks?
I go to the one at North Park Mall, the River Bend Food Pantry. We can go once a week. Sometimes they'll have meat where we can get meat. Sometimes they have milk. Sometimes they have fruit. But it seems like some of their shelves are empty on some things because I know they're getting low.
Do you have to make choices in a given day? What you're going to eat, where you're going to go, what you got to do?
Sometimes not. Like sometimes I'll make a menu for the week of what food we have here at the house. And that way, me and my daughter know kind of what we're making that night.
What do you make?
Sometimes I'll make chicken breasts that are dipped in eggs and then breaded with flour or breadcrumbs. And then I'll fry them and make mashed potatoes and gravy. And sometimes we'll eat green beans so Haley can have the green beans. And she's doing really well of eating green beans and potatoes. We're going to try her on peas soon.
If you have an 8-month-old that's eating vegetables, I'm in awe. Good work.
Yeah, she's doing really good with them.
She was in Head Start, but it closed?
Yeah, it closed October 31st. They gave us a paper saying that since the government was shut down, that Head Start had to close down until further notice. Me and my daughter were a little upset about it because Head Start was our lifeline. I could do schoolwork while Haley was at Head Start. My daughter could go to high school and get her education. With Head Start closing, it's hard. to do anything with the single, you know, single mom and single grandma, because we don't have other places we could take her.
How's your daughter doing?
She's doing okay. I mean, stress of being a teenager, stress of having a baby, but she goes to school every day, sees her friends, they cheer her up. Sometimes she goes, Mom, can I go over to this person's house? She goes, will you watch Haley so I could at least, you know, still be a teen? And I said, go. Haley's sleeping. If she wakes up and needs you, I'll call you. You can come and get her and take her with your friends.
You're a student too, I gather, right?
Yep, I go to Southeastern Community College in Burlington online.
Okay, and can I ask what you're studying?
Early childhood education. Right now I'm in field experience for school, which means I go into a daycare center once a week for 3 hours a day, but it's kind of hard when I have Haley home right now.
With Head Start closed, how is Haley's day different?
Well, she's used to a routine at Head Start. It's hard to do those routines because I'm not a person that sits on the floor all the time and does things. You know, I do other things in the house. And when she wasn't able to go back, she started crying. She just wasn't herself. She's just not a happy baby lately, and she's barely sleeping now.
And it was Haley getting, I mean, was she getting food and supplies there too at Head Start?
Yep, they were paying for food, as in formula, baby food. They paid for cereal. They even paid for diapers. They even provided bottles. They provide everything there. And that helped us out a lot.
Are these tough times?
It's really tough time right now with the Head Start closing, food stamps not available for people, especially with Thanksgiving coming. It's kind of hard to get Thanksgiving dinner if I don't have the food stamps to do it, because it is a lot of money to get stuff to make for Thanksgiving dinner. The other night, I was pretty much crying myself to sleep, not knowing what's going to happen with, you know, how I'm going to get to daycare when I have Haley all the time, if we're going to be able to do much with food. It's just, it's a lot of stress.
How much longer do you think you can live like this?
Probably a couple more weeks.
A couple more weeks, that's not a lot of time.
No. I mean, I'm going to see if I can find other pantries and things like that to go to just to get by. But I'm just hoping that they open up so everybody can go back to their lives and be able to eat and survive.
Nicole Hines, Davenport, Iowa. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yep.
As Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, strives to deport more immigrants, it is increasing its surveillance tools. But critics warn these new technologies can violate privacy and civil liberties. NPR's Jude Joffe Block joins us now. Jude, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
What are some of the tools that ICE agents are using these days?
Well, they've got new contracts to monitor social media and help find people's locations. ICE has also revived a contract with a company called Paragon Solutions, which is known for making spyware that can hack into cell phones. But one big thing that's new is an app ICE and Border Patrol agents have in the field. Social media videos show they're using it to scan people's faces during encounters on the street in an attempt to identify them and figure out if they're deportable.
Jude, how does this app work?
Well, there's still a lot that's unknown. But one of these videos that was first reported by 404 Media was shot outside of Chicago. And you see Border Patrol agents approaching two young people.
I said, nervous, relax. If you just tell me that you were born here and give me an ID, you'll be good.
The young man filming the encounter says he doesn't have ID. And then the agent turns to his colleague and asks,
can you do facials?
Can you do facial, he says. And his colleague pulls out his phone and holds it up and appears to scan his face, though it's possibly took a photo. The video was posted by someone claiming to be the cousin of one of the boys who was stopped. The poster didn't respond to a request about the post, but NPR was able to verify exactly where it was taken. We did get a statement from ICE, and they didn't answer questions about this app, but said nothing new here. For years, law enforcement across the nation has leveraged technological innovations to fight crime.
Jude, do we know if this technology can be used to identify essentially everybody, U.S. citizens?
Well, a group of Democratic senators has been trying to get answers to that question and others about this app since September, but haven't gotten them from ICE. They've called on ICE to stop using this technology and reiterated that demand on Monday. My colleague Martin Costi spoke to Democratic Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey.
This type of on-demand surveillance is harrowing, and it should put all of us on guard. It chills speech, it erodes privacy, it ultimately undermines our democracy.
He expressed concern that this tool could be used against people who criticize the government or protesters.
What safeguards exist to try to ensure that these technologies are not abused?
Well, I asked that to ICE and DHS, and we didn't hear back. I also spoke with legal and privacy experts who told me that our current legal and regulatory framework just isn't robust enough to ensure that these kinds of new tools are used with the appropriate oversight and accountability that's really needed. Emily Tucker is with Georgetown Law School's Center on Privacy and Technology.
Immigration powers are being used to justify mass surveillance of everybody.
And she says it's a mistake to think this doesn't affect every one of us.
And here's Jude Joffe Block. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's been some strange sightings in Ireland. Locals in County Clare thought they were hallucinating when they spotted a mysterious beast roaming through the woods. Then a truck driver captured the animal on video, and the grainy footage revealed a large tan-colored creature with a shaggy mane that from a distance looked like a lion, the king of the jungle in Ireland? The video went viral, of course, on social media. Some thought it might be fake, but with the possible lion on the loose, public safety was on the line. So the Irish police were drafted, and after a week of sleuthing, they solved the case. It turns out the lion in question was just a large Newfoundland dog with a rather leonine haircut. By the way, vets recommend you don't shave these water dogs, who very much need their protective coat. But the name of this magnificent creature that had been the talk of the island and been mistaken for a lion, the name is Mouse. That's right, Mouse. And I wonder if Mouse can roar like a, you get it now. You're listening to NPR News.
18 minutes after 8 o'clock. Good morning. Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, it's all about dancing. 10 o'clock, Dan Lentz, your volunteer host for Backport Harmony. At noon, the recorded history of jazz with Paul Kivi. And 1 o'clock, we have Native Lights, followed at 1:30 by the new Season Watch podcast. You can also find that podcast at our website, kaxe.org. It is time to get rid of that old car, truck, or boat before you're stuck with it for another winter. KAXE's Cars program makes it quick and easy. The proceeds from your unwanted vehicle become fuel for your favorite community radio station. Visit kaxe.org/cars to get started, or call Heather at 218-326-1234 during business hours to get started. Thank you so much for supporting People Powered Radio.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234. Or go online to kaxe.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Klein Jamboree next Monday.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Fast broadband is widely available in urban areas, but not in many rural communities. Government figures show about 1 in 5 residents don't have reliable access to the Internet, and that is despite decades of efforts made to try to reach underserved areas. States were close to putting millions of dollars for broadband to use earlier this year when the Trump administration put out new guidance. Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope has this report.
Antlers, Oklahoma is a small rural town, population just over 2,000. Chris Bailey works at the Oklahoma State University Extension Office in Pushmataha County.
So, Southeast Oklahoma, we are very rural. We have small communities, which I love. Beautiful country. We have a lot of timber industry, a lot of farming.
Bailey helps connect farmers and families to educational resources and knows many of them don't have good internet. That includes Bailey's other office in a neighboring county.
It still is not good enough for us to upgrade our phone systems to an internet-based phone.
For years, federal and state governments have been working to expand internet connection, especially in rural communities. In 2023, Congress allocated about $42 billion for states through the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, or BEAD, program. States were gearing up to start those projects, but in June, the Trump administration pressed pause and issued new guidance.
We were days from announcing where we were, and then the rules change.
Mike Sanders, the executive director of the Oklahoma Broadband Office, says his state's plans had to change.
Where we had 8 to 10 months leading up to that, we had 90 days. Everything was condensed in a year's work, I kid you not, into 3 months.
The Trump administration wanted states to consider different types of technology and the lowest cost options.
So we're not going to be looking at sort of the best quality network. We're going to be looking at the least expensive networks.
Drew Gardner is with the Benton Institute for Broadband and Society, which advocates for reliable and affordable internet nationwide. He says fiber optic lines have been the gold standard for years. Now, satellite and fixed wireless are playing a bigger role in state proposals. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration, or NTIA, is the agency overseeing the program. It says Oklahoma would save about $225 million under a new plan in which about 35% of the state's broadband network would be satellite and fixed wireless. Although cheaper to install than fiber, some question whether those other technologies will be as reliable and long-lasting. In Wisconsin, Gail Hike is the community development specialist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She says that state decided to lower its broadband fiber content from 93 to 73%.
We're hearing from communities that are concerned. What's that going to mean for sustainability? What's that going to mean as far as in some topography areas?
Satellite and fixed wireless beam service over radio waves, which can get blocked by trees, mountains, or a bad storm. But because it's cheaper, the whole BEAD program will cost less. NTIA says as states and territories submit new plans, it projects the program's price to drop $17 billion. Each state was given an initial budget amount, and now it's unclear where any leftover money will end up. Gardner says it's up to the NTIA.
They are being very cagey about what they're going to let states do with that money. By law, it is the state's money. We're just waiting for NTIA to say what they can do with it.
In Oklahoma, Sanders says if the decision comes soon, the federal money will help them connect broadband in the last, toughest-to-reach places.
When it's all said and done, I believe Oklahoma will be very proud with the product that we have produced. However, there's a big however here, everything will now lie with NTIA.
Sanders hopes to have shovels in the ground next spring. For NPR News, I'm Anna Pope in Antlers, Oklahoma.
And now, it's time for sports. College football coaching chaos, but boy, it's lucrative. And make room for the tallest man in basketball. Sports reporter Michelle Steele joins us now. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us. Michelle, are you there with us?
Scott, I am. Yes. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Scott. Good to be with you. Alabama hosts LSU tonight. A lot of attention is on the person who isn't there, fired coach Brian Kelly. To let him go, they're going to pay him $54 million. And LSU is just the latest university to let go of their coach at enormous cost. The AP reports that buyouts for assistant head coaches have reached almost $185 million. Now, Michelle, this is going to sound naive, but these are educational institutions, right? In the business of higher learning. And couldn't at least some of all those millions be spent on education or maybe scholarships for students from low-income families?
Yeah, I wish I wasn't laughing at your question, but that's kind of the state of college sports right now, and that's what critics of the game, of the sport, have been talking about for years. It's a professional league masquerading as part of an educational institution. You're right. $54 million to one guy not to coach is wild. You just don't see that in the pros. You could argue that college is more pro than the pros, right? There's no salary cap. Players can kind of come and
go. That's right.
But as far as LSU is concerned, you know, this new coaching search is going to be watched very closely, not just because the governor is getting involved, but it is considered the best job in college football, at least this cycle. Before Brian Kelly, every coach in the 21st century at LSU won a national championship. He did not. He did not win. And that was unacceptable for them.
Interesting in baseball this week, Colorado Rockies, which were the worst team in the major leagues this past season, are turning to Paul DePodesta to help turn things around. Now, he is the same person who pioneered the use of analytics with the Oakland A's. He was partly portrayed, it was an amalgam of characters, by Jonah Hill in the film Moneyball. Boy, I sense a sequel, but he has to help turn the Rockies around.
Yeah, Moneyball 2, Electric Boogaloo. How do you go from the worst team in football to the worst team in baseball and expect to turn everything around? But that's what they want Paul DePodesta to do.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's what they want. He was their chief strategy officer. Lives in California, but you know, works in Cleveland technically. He was made famous by that Michael Lewis book and, of course, that movie. He was that baseball stats nerd, found value in places where other people weren't looking. He hasn't been in baseball for 10 years, and the Rockies, from what I'm hearing, are about 10 years behind in the analytics department. So this is the ultimate analytics test, because you're a baseball fan, Scott. You know Coors Field. The air is so thin there, sometimes routine fly balls can turn into home runs real quick. But if he can make the Rockies successful, maybe he should get an Oscar and a Nobel Prize for physics if he figures that out.
Oh, what a nice thought. And finally, college basketball this week, a record. Olivier Rioux from Quebec took the floor for the Florida Gators to become the tallest college basketball player of all time. He is 7'9". I mean, if the only play the Gators need is just to, you know, say, stand under the hoop, Olivier, we'll get you the ball, stuff it in, and we'll do it all over again.
Sure, slam dunk each time. The hoop is only 10 feet. He's almost 8 feet tall. He's 7'9". He is 8 inches taller, Scott, than Shaq. His primary defensive move is just to look down at the shooter.
Yeah.
You know, forget boxing out. He just needs to stand next to guys. I've actually procured every opposing team's pregame scouting report, and it says avoid the guy who is almost 8 feet tall. He's developmental. He's developmental, but fun to watch for Florida fans.
All right. Sports reporter Michelle Steele, talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
See you next time.
Jamaica is racing to reopen its tourism industry after Hurricane Melissa slammed into the island last week. The Category 5 storm caused widespread damage at some of the country's most popular destinations. And with the start of peak tourism season just weeks away, will the island be open for business? Edmund Bartlett is Jamaica's Minister of Tourism and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
How bad was the damage to tourism spots by Hurricane Melissa?
Well, the hurricane hit the western quadrant of the island. Overall, just about 60% perhaps of our tourism assets were affected by the hurricane. The extent to which the damages were done ranged from extreme in one instance, in only one instance, to moderate and in a much lighter way.
May I ask about some areas specifically that are familiar to tourists, such as Montego Bay and Negril?
Montego Bay was more severely hit than all the other destinations in Jamaica. Negril is in relatively good nick. Port Antonio is absolutely not touched. Kingston and some areas along the south coast were in good nick.
Minister Bartlett, how important is tourism to Jamaica's economy?
Tourism is 30% of our GDP, but its implications are deeper and wider. In addition to knowing that tourism provides more than 55% of the foreign exchange that we generate, also employs 20% of the labor force in the country. So it's hugely important to the economy of Jamaica.
What needs to be done to receive tourists in a few weeks?
Right. So the good news all around is that our airports are working. We have established the timeline for the full opening of the destination for December 15. A number of our hotels are now open and are scheduling for opening. So by the time we get to the 15th, more than 70-80% of all our room stock and attractions will be available.
What's the biggest challenge you face right now?
Oh, the biggest challenge we face is to get our workers back with their physical assets back intact, their houses, to ensure that they have water and light and all the amenities that will make them able to produce at the highest level. And that's a big, strong mission, and we're going after it with a lot of energy and resources.
You sound very hopeful.
Oh, yes, because we've worked hard at it. We have a recovery task force that is working daily, minutely. The government has responded extremely well to enable the reconstruction activities. And one of the things that we want to emphasize in all of this is resilience. We're not just building back. We're building back better, and we're building back with the knowledge of the technology that is required to deal with the elements of weather and climatic change that we're experiencing.
Is there something you learned through this experience of Hurricane Melissa that you'll take into the future?
Oh, yes. For one, we have to review where our settlements are. We have to manage better to ensure they're protected and safeguarded against flooding and erosion. We know, for example, that we have to look at resilience in energy and particularly the distribution of energy. We're looking at entombing the cables underground for light and power distribution. So we remove all those light poles that are now susceptible to the effect of the winds that come with these weather conditions. We also have to look at even our building codes with a knowledge of the type of hurricane that are likely to be a feature of the future.
Edmund Bartlett is Jamaica's Minister of Tourism. Thanks so much for being with us. Good season ahead to you, sir.
Thank you, Scott. And I want to close by just saying to the audience and everybody, I know that you all feel the pain with us and you empathize. The greatest way for you to continue to show love and support for us is to visit us.
and you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Since at least the time of the science fiction writer Jules Verne, people have dreamed of being able to live underwater. In the 1960s and 70s, the U.S. and French governments were among those who created undersea habitats where researchers could live and work for extended periods. It's been almost 40 years, though, since the last undersea habitat went into the water. But NPR's Greg Allen reports on a new one created by a company with ambitious plans for underwater research and exploration.
The company is called Deep. It was founded 4 years ago in the United Kingdom with a goal, it says, of making humans more aquatic. It unveiled its first step in that process recently in Miami. It's Vanguard, an undersea habitat where a crew of four can live and work for a week or more without resurfacing. From the outside, it's a big yellow steel tank, about 40 feet long. I go inside with Deep's Roger Garcia.
This is what's known as the wet porch, where you're standing right now. This is where people come in and out.
Below us, covered by a hatch, is the habitat's moon pool. Once Vanguard is deployed underwater, anchored to the seafloor, this door to the ocean will remain open.
As long as the air pressure in here remains a little bit above the water pressure or equal to the water pressure, the air-water interface is going to stay below where you're standing right now.
To get to the habitat's living quarters and workspace, we go feet first through the open hatch.
Good job.
Yeah.
Very good bunch of heads there.
It's not big, but it's an economical design, not unlike an underwater RV. Bunks fold down to a comfortable seating area. There's a small bathroom and windows on each end so that people in the habitat can keep an eye on divers working outside. It's functional, not fancy, but Garcia is proud Vanguard is almost ready. Before working with Deep, he spent much of his career on the only other undersea habitat still in operation, Aquarius, a research station in Key Largo. Aquarius is nearly 40 years old. In his time working there, Garcia says he became disappointed as he saw interest and funding decline.
And then here comes Deep. Just the thought of keeping the legacy going, of living underwater and also making humans aquatic in the future, to me, it just made me happy.
Deep is a privately owned company with an ambitious goal, to establish a permanent human presence underwater. Former hedge fund manager Sean Wolpert is a board member.
Our mission is getting eyeballs beneath the surface of the ocean to allow humans to go down on the seabed, be productive across many different tasks, but also do it in such a way where it helps to de-risk that entire process.
For researchers and others who dive for extended periods, an undersea habitat provides the gift of time. With immediate access to the water, Garcia says people staying in the habitat can work up to 9 hours a day.
So for them, that's like a game changer, because they will tell you that 10 days of work inside an underwater habitat and the data they can gather from that research could equate to 6 months of work in some cases.
Vanguard is a prototype. Deep says it will be placed at an as yet unidentified location 60 feet below the surface. Chief Technology Officer Norman Smith says Deep has already begun work on a larger undersea habitat that can be expanded to provide space for a dozen or more.
The vision for the company is a roadmap of larger habitats, modular habitats, to be installed in oceans all over the world.
It's a bold vision, but perhaps not more outlandish than a privately funded space exploration company might have seemed a few decades ago. Deep board member Sean Wolpert.
I've been in very high-level strategic sovereign discussions about creating a community on the seabed. So having 130 people living on the seabed by 2035.
Deep says the first step, getting its prototype Vanguard deployed and operational, should happen by the end of the year. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is NPR News.
It is 8:39. Good morning. Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. 9 o'clock, Stay Human, a mix of story and song hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, stories about dancing. Support comes from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop and on Facebook. Lots going on this weekend. You can find a full list at events up north at kaxe.org. You can also find events for next week. One thing happening this evening, Bemidji Contra Dance is meeting at the Susie and Hondo Dance Studio. There will be a potluck at 5:30, beginning with dancing at 6:30. No experience or partners needed. Everything will be taught by a caller while you dance to live music from the O'Neill Family Band. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition on KAXE.
Snyder with these headlines. Hospital officials in Gaza say Israel has returned the bodies of 15 Palestinians as part of the U.S. brokered ceasefire. The return came shortly after the Israeli military said it had identified the remains of a hostage turned over last night as that of an Israeli man who died while fighting Hamas during the attack that started the war. In Ukraine, Russia launched another large-scale drone and missile attack overnight. Authorities say an apartment building in the city of Dnipro was hit, killing at least three people and injuring 12 others. And back in Washington, the Senate remains locked in a stalemate, but senators are working this weekend for the first time since the government shutdown began more than a month ago. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Let me tell you about Gabriel Dax. He's a Cold War-era travel writer who goes all over the world. That nicely positions him to also be a British secret agent. But he also gets envelopes of cash from the KGB, which MI6 thinks is just fine. Keeps his cover. British intelligence sends Gabriel to Guatemala on a friendly errand for the CIA, but the trip has an unforeseen lethal result, and that will pluck a wire inside Gabriel when he's sent to West Berlin to find termites, traitors in spy slang, shortly before the visit of President John F. Kennedy. The Predicament is the second novel in a planned Gabriel Dax trilogy by William Boyd, the honored British novelist, who joins us now from London. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Scott. Thank you.
This is the second book in the trilogy, as we said. Is Gabriel by now more of a spy than a travel writer?
Yes, reluctantly so, I think. He's discovered he's actually quite good at the job. He has resources and he has instincts that actually suit his spying life, but he's constantly moaning about how it's taking him away from his real life as a writer. But he's getting in deeper and deeper.
There's cash payments he takes from the KGB with permission. Does he declare them on his tax filings with an Inland Revenue?
I suspect not. He's instructed by his mysterious and alluring MI6 handler, Faith Green, to spend the money very obviously. So he's bought a cottage, he's bought a motorbike, he's buying paintings. He's just profiting from this, as you said, KGB cover that he has. He's meant to be a termite, a mole himself, but of course it gets extra complicated.
And let me ask you about his relationship with his handler. And that phrase becomes a little fraught from British intelligence. Faith Green, they can also be involved, can't they?
Yes, I mean, there is an emotional dimension to their relationship as well as a professional one. And in fact, it's not too much to say that Gabriel is smitten by Faith. And she rather exploits that, though I think she also enjoys the dalliance. But there's always a source of worry that somehow things are not what they seem. And I think Gabriel's life can be described as a persistent erosion of trust, and it makes him more and more anxious.
Gabriel meets with a Guatemalan trade union leader and a former priest known as Padre Tiago. And the Padre expects to get a message from Gabriel from Fidel Castro. Gabriel doesn't have any such message. Is this a lapse or intentional?
No, it's a setup. Gabriel is being used because Padre Tiago, who might win the next presidential election, is in hiding, and the powers that be that don't like him want to know where he is. And in fact, Gabriel is a kind of, he's a lure in a way to find out where Padre Tiago is hiding. He thinks he's going to interview Padre Tiago, but in fact, there's a far more nefarious objective underway, and it has a bad outcome.
The story moves on to West Germany, following that thread from Guatemala. The CIA does seem to have a case against President Kennedy, don't they?
I am a conspiracy theorist when it comes to the assassination of JFK, but it depends what conspiracy you choose. There are various possible explanations, but my theory, which I outline in more detail in the novel, is that there were rogue elements of the CIA, discontented operatives, particularly after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. One forgets that JFK and Bobby Kennedy were not universally popular at the time. And the whole Guatemala issue is to do with regime change and destabilization in Central America, which the CIA were heavily involved with the mafia as well. So I take these elements that are there as potential explanations of what happened and stitch them together to make a, in my opinion, quite a convincing conspiracy about how JFK was assassinated.
Is that a literary exercise for you or what?
Yes, it's a literary exercise because I'm a realistic novelist, and I want the worlds of my novels, which are fictional, to be as authentic and as plausible as possible. And throughout my fiction, over the years, I've always introduced real events, historical events, real historical people, in order to give it that kind of ring of truth, or to make the reader sometimes think, is this true or is this something that Boyd has made up? I like that doubt to be implanted in the reader's mind.
What's it like to spend so much time in the 1960s for you?
The 1960s coincided pretty much with my teenage years, and so I have vivid memories of them and vivid memories of the events that took place. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember the assassination of JFK. And so when revisiting them for these novels is a kind of time travel for me. When I talk about the clothes people wore, the drinks they drank, the meals they ate, I'm tapping into my own memories of that period. And it's, you know, it is a long time ago now, but it's still very vivid to me. And it's a perfect place, perfect time to set a spy novel, because the Cold War was at its height. Mm-hmm. And the good guys and the bad guys were, in theory, clearly defined.
I figured out while reading this novel, you and I are the same age within days of each other.
Oh, right, right.
And we've both grown up with the character of the suave British spy.
Yes.
Why has that lasted so much? Let me tell you my theory, okay?
Okay.
All right. Ian Fleming and some other people needed to make up something following, you know, Britain's darkest days in which they prevailed, but they wanted to be back on top of the world, hence 007.
Yes, but I think you've got to separate 007 from the more serious spy novels. My theory is that one of the few things we British are good at is betraying our country. And
well, the Cambridge Five, you're thinking.
Yeah, the Cambridge Five. And I think the obsession with spying and spy novels is to do with this notion, particularly in World War II and post-war Cold War, the fact that we had so many traitors at the heart of our establishment, and they were well-educated, mm-hmm. Middle-class, privileged people. I mean, Kim Philby, the super spy, was a Soviet double agent at the heart of MI6 for over 20 years. And I think that's where, the suavity comes in, that it's not some guy with a grudge. These are privileged people who intellectually decide to work for the Russians. And that's an abiding fascination. I don't think anybody has fully explained why these men consistently and for such a long time were traitors.
William Boyd's new novel, The Predicament, and there's another one to come. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thank you very much, Scott.
In Joachim Trier's new film, Sentimental Value, Gustav Borg, an esteemed Norwegian director, offers a popular actress the starring role in a rich family drama. But she says no. "We can't work together," she tells him. "We don't communicate." The director, played by Stellan Skarsgård, is her father. Sentimental Value is Norway's entry for Best Feature Film at the next Academy Awards. It also stars Renate Reinsva and Elle Fanning. And a caution, this conversation includes mention of suicide. Stellan Skarsgård, one of the world's most revered actors, joins us now from Los Angeles. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Gustav, the father and director, doesn't know his two daughters very well, does he?
No, he doesn't. I mean, he was a bit of a absent father due to divorce, among other things. He wants to reach them and he wants to have contact with them again, but he does not know how to do it. He's extremely clumsy. He's fumbling his way through it. And it becomes comic, but it also becomes very sad.
Is there a part of him that hopes that making a film will not only make a good film, but repair a relationship?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think it's the fun thing with playing a character is often to play him as unconscious of most important things in life. It might be so, but he does not know it because he is desperate to do the film. And he goes to another actress and tries to make it with her.
Well, and I want to ask you about that because when his daughter says no, he winds up offering the role to a famous American actress, Rachel Kemp, played by Elle Fanning. There are unexpected flashes of what I'll just call tough humor.
Mm-hmm.
The footstool thing. Can I get you to recount that for us?
He's showing her around in the house, which has a very important role in the film, by the way. And he shows the room where his mother committed suicide by hanging herself. And he puts a stool there, and she's going to play the mother, and she's going to put the stool and climb up and hang herself. And he says that the stool is the actual stool that his mother used. And she goes, "Oh, no, oh, God," and all that kind of stuff. And then later he reveals that, no, it was an old, it's just an IKEA stool, and it wasn't that one at all. Of course, it's a joke. It's a joke at her expense in a way, but not so bad.
Is it okay for people to laugh at that in the film?
It's okay for them to laugh at everything.
In her own way, is Nora as engrossed in her theater career as her father was in his movie career?
Yeah, she is. They're both artists. That's why this conflict is in a way that can artists, do they all have problems coping with and compromising with the real life and family life and children and stuff? Yeah, probably they do because their work is not only their work, it's their identity. And if you have to compromise with your identity, you don't become yourself anymore. And it's an unsolvable problem.
And you have several children in the film business, don't you?
Yeah, I got 6 in the business, I think, and 2 not in the business.
Any of this remind you of anything personal?
That's exactly what my son said. My second son said when he'd seen the film, "Anything remind you of something personal?" And I said, "No, of course not." But I had to rethink that. Of course it does remind me of things. I have been a present father much more than Gustav Borg has. And basically since 1989, when I stopped working at the Royal Dramatic Theater, I've been spending 8 out of 12 months at home and only been shooting for 4 months a year. So I've been changing diapers for 8 months a year. You can say that I've been present in that sense, but you don't know how much you've been present in mentally, because you might have been distracted. And also, if you have 8 children, you have 8 different individuals. Some of them need more attention than others, and some of them need more encouragement than others. And so I understand what he was referring to, my son.
And did you draw your portrayal of Gustav, the director, out of any of the directors with whom you've worked?
No, I didn't. The instinct was immediately, oh, who shall I choose? This is the moment for revenge, and I can make fun of a director like that. But I didn't, because I needed him to be very sensible director, very smart director, and capable of doing very refined and nuanced psychological work with an actress, because he's good at it in his work, but he's not good at it with his daughters. That's the sort of not uncommon thing, because your art is more controllable.
I've read you had a stroke in recent years.
Yeah, I had it 3 years ago.
Your performance in this film is so strong. May I ask, did you have to learn how to do anything differently?
I can't remember my lines anymore. That and I have some language problems. But that was helped by having an earpiece and a prompter in my ear. But then it's not as convenient as you think. Oh, he says all the lines, so you just have to repeat them. It doesn't work like that. He or she has to say the lines very fast, very neutral, and at the same time as your co-actor is saying his lines. It's elaborate because to find the rhythm, to work out the rhythm of the scene.
As we said, you're one of the most respected actors in the world, but I didn't know until reading up that you've never been nominated for an Oscar.
Well, actually, I think there's been one male Swede who has been nominated, and that's Max von Sydow. He's been nominated twice, and that's it.
If you're nominated now, what would that mean to you?
I don't know. I guess I'll go on with my life as I've always done. I'm managed to reach the age of 74 without an Oscar, so I could probably go on. But it would be an enormous honor, of course, and I would be much more happy than I will admit.
What's ahead for you?
Well, I got to do this Oscars campaign now. Then I'll wait and see. I haven't... there's not that many really good scripts for old people. Well, if a younger man writes about an old man, he writes him like with a cane. I got to wait for a role that's interesting, that is not sort of Alzheimer.
Well, I hope it comes soon, because you're a lot of fun to talk to.
Well, let's talk again then.
I hope so. Stellan Skarsgård stars in the new film, Sentimental Value, in theaters now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for calling.
And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, please call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, 10 o'clock, Back Porch Harmony, with your volunteer host, Dan Lentz. Weather for today, partly sunny, highs in the low to mid-30s, winds from the north 5 to 15, our lows tonight in the mid to upper teens. And tomorrow, partly sunny, highs again in the low 30s, with blustery northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. For Monday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-30s. If you are interested in becoming an on-air volunteer DJ at KAXC, we have our fall training coming up. You can join us Wednesday, November 12th at KAXC in Grand Rapids, or Bemidji at KBXC Thursday, November 13th. You can choose either class. Both run from 5:30 to 7. Email volunteer at KAXC.org for more info or to confirm your attendance. VFW Post 1720 in Grand Rapids invites the community to honor veterans this Tuesday, November 11th. Doors will open at 11 a.m. with lunch and a program at noon. Find more Veterans Day events at KAXC.org. Look for Events Up North.